Go Wild is a free social community created for and by hunters. This means that unlike mainstream social media, your trophy pictures won't be censored. They're encouraged. As you spend time on Go Wild, you will earn awesome rewards such as gift cards, free swag, and big discounts on brands like Garmin and Vortex. You will even earn $10 just for signing up. Visit downloadgowild.com and sign up today.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. A couple of housekeeping things. First off, I'd appreciate if everyone could go in and give this a five-star review and comment. Those keep us up on the chain, keep us in the Google zone, and that's something that's really important for me and the guests on this podcast, because, of course, we're contributing. You know, as time goes on, there's going to be more information. We've got a bunch of good podcasts coming up, and I'll talk about that a little bit at the end. In the last podcast, we talked about logging and sales and strategy, and we've got a lot of feedback on that one. So I appreciate people reaching out after those podcasts. So thank you, and thank you for listening. The other piece of this is I am going to be doing a speaking engagement, and I wanted to kind of give that information. It's September 16th and 17th in Canandaigua, New York. It's at the Woods and Wildlife Outdoor Show. It's the first year they're having a show. I'm not sure the number of people. I'll have a booth there. Myself, my good buddy Josh, who's my partner, and my daughter, she's 4 years old, will be at that event. So it'll be fun. I'm doing a speaking engagement, I think, around 6 p.m. Friday, the 16th, and then sometime Saturday morning. And I'll have a booth again right next to the venue. The address of that location is 3349 Gainham Road in Canandaigua. I'll put it in the show notes. If you want to reach out to me, great. I'd like to meet people that are listening to this podcast or in the New York area. Please come see me, and I'll be continuing to do more of those speaking engagements. All right, enough with that. Let's get into the specifics. So I got Todd Shippey back from Empire Land Management. In this podcast, we're going to freestyle talk a little bit, but we do have some topics that we want to get into, specifically issues he's dealing, you know, with in the Midwest that are pertinent. And I intend to debate with him a little bit on this, so it should be a good conversation. Hey, Todd, how are you doing?
Good. How are you, John?
I'm good. What's going on in your world?
Not too much. Battling the drought. I'm in a dry pocket here. I've got some of the lands that I manage just a little bit to the south and a little bit to the north have sufficient moisture, and it's a cakewalk. But right where I live and due west where I manage property and due east, we're in a pocket of dry that's driving me crazy. And so we just did some things to pivot into the swamps and adjust our strategy a little bit to still make do. But it's hard to get switchgrass to grow when it doesn't rain at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And beyond that, you know, you're thinking about, I guess, in the arid climates, any succulents, you know, if obviously I think of places like Texas and then obviously in the Midwest, you know, your forb, the water contents of forbs are typically in that 60-90% range. We're kind of going in the senescence period. So, you know, the quality of food is starting to degrade at this point. There's not a lot you can do when you don't have water. The nice part about living in the East, you know, the East rather than the Midwest or West, is we don't typically experience the drought. There's been instances of drought. It's usually short term. But generally speaking, we don't have many, you know, much drought in our areas. You know, respectively, you know, our food availability is pretty good. You know, the some of the tricks and strategies we can probably talk about, you know, in this podcast today, but, you know, that you're in those situations, you're susceptible to the weather. And that really, you know, puts a hurting on the deer herd in totality. What are you seeing out there right now? I know that you're trying to come up with some ideas and concepts and be innovative, but, you know, what are you seeing, at least in the field, like from a, you know, I'm assuming the crops are suffering and in some areas, what are you seeing?
Absolutely. Everything's stunted and the crops, you know, from a food plot standpoint, you know, the farmers I kind of, a strategy, a normal strategy is let the farmers get their stuff in and start feeding the deer first. So you come in behind and plant your plots and it takes some of the pressure off of them. But this year that worked until we got to fall plots. So it really stressed the switchgrass. There was just high heat and zero moisture to get it to germinate or get it to come up. And then of course the weeds are already stratified, so they're good to go at the first flicker of sunlight. And then, but the fall crops, to get those established, have been, even the summer crops, I had a hard time getting the sorghum is only about 8 to 10 inches. I don't know if we did get an inch of rain last night, so I'm hoping that's going to push those sorghum fields up. And, just about the time I'm coming in to put winter rye in them anyhow. So it's been a struggle this year with the dry weather. I rigged up a trash pump and a sprinkler system. I bought a rainwater sprinkler. It's got an inch and a half intake on it and a 3/8 hole, so it can run mud right through it. Actually, I've been pumping water out of ditches, the water fields, and out of ponds and everywhere, and using that sprinkler gives 138 gallons a minute. And the trash pump goes 158. So in those areas where I've been close to a pond or a ditch or anywhere I can suck water from, I've been doing it. It's been pretty effective that way, getting alfalfa, clover, and my summer plots up. So, but some of the places are just remote from water. You don't have that opportunity.
So, you know, that goes to tell you one thing, at least in some of these states where, you know, water is a limiting factor or you're relying on the weather conditions, you know, considering your property purchase, having a water source on there. I was talking to Perry Batten from Drury Outdoors this week, and Todd, he's doing the same thing you're doing. You know, they're taking water out of ponds and, you know, dumping into their food plots, you know, dumping 20, 30,000 gallons on a food plot in order to get, you know, the plants to grow, and essentially doing something artificially in order to support, you know, the deer's nutritional demands. And frankly, the benefit's going to be great for them because they're going to suck every deer in from every other landowner's property adjacent to them. That said, you know, when I'm making decisions and looking at like a basic habitat need, you know, water is critical. And some of these areas that don't have water or have limited water, you're in, you know, maybe an arid area or you're in a bluff zone that doesn't have, you know, water sources, those things become problematic. So I think one of the considerations is the basic elements of the habitat to support, you know, nutritional demands and needs of deer are water. So consider that when you're purchasing property. And in this case, if you're experiencing drought, you've got somebody like Todd that can come in and leverage that water source to benefit, you know, your particular habitat. So,
well, it's land management 101, food, water, and cover. I mean, that's one leg of the stool that you have to have. So wouldn't go near a piece of property that doesn't have all three legs of the stool, or being able to add the third leg of water in the form of a pond or a dike or some way to get some form of water there.
Yeah. And if you think about this, you know, deer, just think of a deer's physiology, just like humans, right? A huge percentage of their body is comprised of water. So naturally, and very similar to humans, you know, deer can go for some period of time without food, but water is essential. And I don't know the statistical volume, you know, it could be
60%. All humans 60%. Are 60% water. Infants are 80%. Adults are 60.
I think the adult deer are probably around 50 to 60%, somewhere in that range, maybe mid 60s, depending on the age of the deer. As the deer start to get older, they start to lean out a little bit. They don't have the same water content. So all good points, and certainly, you know, very important to us. I mean, basically it's a, you know, water is used for metabolism purposes. And the other piece of it is it's used to control body temperature. And that's really critical, even in some hunting decisions. You know, you get into these early season hunts and it's super droughty, and, you know, any water source or food source that's available to them, you know, that has a high water component is going to be utilized. And obviously that will be a strategy for you trying to select where to hunt deer. So just a thought there. All right, Todd, let's get into drought strategies. We talked a little bit about Perry throwing, you know, thousands of gallons, and you're throwing thousands of gallons.
So yeah, I'm glad you said that number too, because I've had a couple people bring up, well, what if I take a 500 gallon tank and a pump and a sprinkler? And that's like, I'll give an example. To fill my pool, like just a couple inches, I'll run my hose for hours, all day long, to get my pool, 16 by 32 pool, just to come up an inch and a half. But last night we had an inch of rain and it's up an inch. So rain, like the volume of water that you need to put on a plot, is not going to get done with just a sprinkler and a hose or a 500 gallon tank. I think Drury's running with a 5,000 gallon tank that they fill and spray out. So the volume of water that you need to put on a plot is a lot of water to even consider getting close to just normal rain. So I'm glad that you mentioned, you know, how much water Perry put on plots the other day.
Yeah, and the idea that you could take a small tank and use that with the basic, you know, spraying. So for foliar spraying, obviously that's a different thing. We're applying nutrients at a very concentrated level across the landscape. That's a different example. Yeah. Whereas we're trying to feed the plants, you know, from a basic consumable, something that they need to utilize in order to survive. Whether it's germinating or you know, just basic survival. So you need that volume. That also brings up another point to me, thinking about, you know, plant demands and, you know, depending again where you are. I talked earlier, we talked a little bit about fodder and we're talking about forbs and, you know, the volume of water in those particular plants. I mean, some plants are 90% water content. You know, that water, once ingested and assimilated in a deer's body, that's how they're able to limit potentially their, it benefits obviously them from a water standpoint. And then obviously there's a water retention component and metabolism component of all that, but it reduces their need to go to water sources. So in some cases, if you're juxtaposing, let's just say a herbaceous area that you're maintaining with high forb content, you may not need, depending on the time of year, you may not need a localized water source like a pond, et cetera. But I have known this for a long, long time. And I'm going to go back to 1998. I was hunting with my father on our farm and we had put in ponds. Okay. So I'm a kid. I'm in my teens. Okay. And we had in place two ponds. We had beavers. We had we had helped them construct waterways. And we realized in those situations, the deer utilization in those areas were a lot higher at certain times of year. And so we started to kind of take a keen interest in this. The other thing that kind of played out in that scenario was, I remember one time my father said, hey, you know, on one of our logging trails and on, I think we had about 26 acres of timber, there was a small opening and kind of like a little water retention area. And we noticed so much utilization in that area. My dad said, you need to start hunting, you know, on that little pool of water, that the deer are hitting that, you know, constantly. So back in 1998, right, a teenager, I observed this occurrence. And it dawned on me at that time that, you know, these water sources were critical. Not knowing a lot about deer, not knowing about their, you know, their biology, it was critical to their well-being. So I add that in there is observation is the criticalness in finding what deer need and demand. And those observations can happen all the time. So trying to figure out the right areas to put water is the other difficult piece of this, Todd. And I struggle with that. So I'm kind of interested in your take.
I'm glad you brought that up, that the utilization of water and the fact that they don't need water, that they can get it from plants. Which is, I think, the biggest misconception on water and whitetail deer. I mean, Southern Deer Group, they studied how much water bucks need during the rut, and it's minimal amount that they can get by. They can get it off of the plants. Water sources, though, if available, are highly utilized for a number of reasons. One, it is still a refreshing drink of water. Two, they smell. Deer's world are based, all animal are based on smell. Especially deer. So it smells like every doe that's been there. It smells like every buck that's been there. It's like going down to the local bar and seeing who's been there. And that's the other draw to a water source, because raccoons, fox, coyote, everybody's been there, and they can tell the health. They can tell everything that's going on by visiting that water source. So part of the draw is not just, they're so, they're just like a food plot, a water source is not something that's so attractive. A deer is going to risk its life and walk in when you didn't use best management practices, getting into your stand and scent control and all of the above. But they are highly attractive when placed, like you said, in the right spot. and maybe with a licking branch by them or some other attractants by them. It's another adjunct to your hunting tools that you can use. And I have great success. I mean, I put in ponds between ponds. I put in a earth blind. I'm a dealer for earth blind water holes. I like them because they can get out of the pond wildlife, that nothing dies inside. I just put one in for a guy who had a regular cattle tank and a rabbit died in it. I couldn't get out the critter stick. I use those. I just put one in literally 100 yards from a pond, and a half hour after I left, the guy had a buck on one of them, and the other one had a whole herd of does on it. They just move right in. It becomes an instant point of interest, something to drink, starts to smell like deer and every other wildlife, and it's a big draw. So just like the three legs of the stool, food, water, and cover, you need, with that water source, I like to put it, I use this example. If you're selling hot dogs on one corner and a guy's selling root beer on the other corner, and I can offer hot dogs and root beer in the middle, where's everybody going to be in line? And that's why I put them right by the edge of food plots, transition areas where they already want to go there to get the food. It only makes sense that they're going to stop right there and drink from that pond because it's available and it's convenient.
Todd, I want you to be very specific in something, and I don't mean to cut you off, but the earthblind water holes or ponds that you're using right now, and I think the shape of them, the contour, the coloration, the depth, the size, like
texture.
Can you kind of go into what you see as the benefit? I know you talked just quickly about dead rodents, et cetera.
Yeah, well, the sharp edges on the cattle tanks that people bury, mice, squirrels, rabbits, critters get inside of them and they can't get out, and then they drown and then they rot inside of the tank. And now you've got this bacteria, you've got this stench, and you got a rotten animal in there, and sometimes in a remote area. So now you got to scoop it out with a bucket. You don't want to dump it right next to the tank, or it's going to just smell like death and actually repel other things other than bringing coyotes and birds. So you have to haul it away, dump it somewhere else. It's a complete hassle. And I find that more and more people always tell me, yeah, before this, I had this die. I just installed a 250-gallon earth blind pond for a guy who had a rabbit die in his. So that the sides are angled and textured, and it has a lip on it, so you can bury it down on the ground so it will self-fill with rain. I fill them with the big totes, and then anything that gets in it can get right back out of it. So I've never had anything so far die in one of them. And then additionally, the complaints that people get are, how do you keep the water from getting stagnant? And I was thinking about this. You and I talked about in the past, my swimming pool sits out here, and deer come every night and drink out of it. I see the tracks up on the concrete. I see the stuff, the deer are coming around. I start thinking, well, if they're drinking chlorinated water, why in a pond? So I looked, I did a Google search, and sure enough, for cattle tanks, because cattle are ruminants as well as deer, you can use 1/2 to 1 ounce per 50 gallons of water of chlorine bleach. And it will keep it clean, and it won't hurt any more than that. It could be harmful to the deer. But so you put that in, and it keeps them from getting stagnant. It stops slime or algae or anything growing on them. And it's a game changer for ponds out in the wild.
Todd, great example and great, observation on your part, just like we were talking about earlier, the importance in 1998, me seeing water, the significance in a deer's life, and you taking this basic example of a pool and saying, well, how can I keep something clean? Because my biggest gripe has been with water holes over the years is most of my clients will not take that water hole, drain it out, and clean it. They will not take the time to do that, and then it becomes stagnant and useless. All right, I want to go into an actual, a practical scenario here. So you're making some decisions. Let's say you have areas of decent topography where there's runoff, or maybe there's a resident stream, but it's not significant. But you're filling up these water holes in these specific areas, and a lot of times it's on a travel pattern, or it's juxtaposed next to, you're saying a food source or even a hunting location for that matter. And we talked about the lip and using the local water to be a resource. Are you more times than not trying to, let's say if there's running water in an area, and I do this a lot with clients, is I'm trying to create small ponds, natural ponds. Would you also, you know, just let's say you don't have, you know, you're digging out an area and maybe there's not a clay based soil. It's a silty soil or a sandy soil. What are you doing in those situations to kind of create a pot or using an earth blind in those scenarios? So to fill up this trough essentially, and then, you know, water eventually flow out of it. What's your strategy there?
Well, first I look at the macro look at, like, where do I want this? How do I want the deer flow? Am I changing the deer flow? Because on many properties, people say, well, I have water. Great. My first question is, where's the water? Well, it's the opposite of where your food is, and the opposite side of the bedding. So you can literally change the flow of your herd by, instead of a deer getting up out of bed and going and getting a drink during the day, and at night, going first to the natural water source, and then coming out to the food well after dark by having available water. That's why I talk about the hot dog and the root beer on each different corner, and the hot dog and the root beer together in the middle. Is you can get your flow, the deer flow, going the right direction because they discover the water source and they move out that way. So once I look at the big picture, where do I want this? How do I want the deer flow? Then I get more of a micro location. Okay, I want it right in here. And then I literally look at it's going to go in this 50-yard range or this. And then I'll look at the land and see, like, is there a dip right here? Is there a little bit of a funnel here? How does this work? And then I look up and use the topography, like, this is hidden by a hill or a tree and a bush, so you have access around. Get into this stand, you'll be able to see it from a gun stand back here, but the deer won't see you. Process of elimination, and then find X marks the spot and punch it in.
So we look at the terrain, obviously, is the major driver, and obviously you kind of just identify locations specifically and using the location to be the identifier, you know, for where you can hunt them or where they're naturally going to want to, you know, transition through. I'm wondering, you know, and this is what I do, and I'll just give you the question. Yeah. I was going to answer. I'm looking at the topography features, specifically the soil type as my next driver, and the related water content or water resources in that area to drive where I'm going to put it. Because preferably I'm using kind of the natural resources. Like, I'd rather go in there with my bucket, you know, take some localized clay, kind of pack it in, build my own little pond. That's generally what I would do. At least that's what I recommend to a lot of clients. That's not always the case in certain landscape types. And in my own personal landscape type, that is not the case in a lot of those elevated areas. So I'm going to use a pond in those locations. So that's just kind of like an earth line pond. I'm going to kind of use one of those, or likely use one of those in those particular locations. That's kind of the discriminator for me. You know, what does your natural setting provide you or offer you to do? And then alternatively, if it doesn't, then you use that as a resource. And I like a couple things with that particular earth blind pond or water trough, is the fact that it is textured and its look is so naturalized. It doesn't stick out like a sore thumb. And I think it's a consideration, because I think a lot of times deer are alarmed by things that are not naturalized in their environment. They come accustomed to them, but it takes a long time. And your example earlier is you punch those in, and next thing you know, you got pictures of the deer, you know, 30 minutes later on that water hole. So that's pretty incredible.
They work great.
Yeah, they work great. So Todd, if you could, I guess, make a decision about the number of water holes on a property, because guys ask me all the time, how many water holes should I put on the property? And that's such a loaded question, because your example earlier, you're trying to pull them from another location. Potentially, you've got conflicting point of views. You may already have water on the property, but is that water in the right location? And the ideal situation is it's in this kind of transition area, headed to maybe a food source or headed maybe to another bedding area. You could be hunting in between a barbell necessarily, and you may have a water hole in between those, and it becomes a social point like you talked about earlier. And again, that's great for deer movement. It enhances the movement more than likely.
Yeah, it becomes a focal point, like a tree point. So like a tree coy, you know, putting a tree out in there and hanging a grapevine off of it near a stand with an auger. Same thing with a water hole. And really that depends on the topography. I just put in, this is a duck hunting place, and I just installed two of them, and he wants a third one. Because of the way the hills are, you can get away with a third one, but they're drawing deer so well that he just wants one by another stump blind that I installed. So we're going to go ahead and put another one in out there because it's just it's getting the deer near the blinds and putting them in more of a focused area where they have opportunity and can observe them. So,
yeah. Well, let me bring up another point, and this is something that I've observed. So there's really no data on this, is looking at two things, right? The deer's natural state and its environment, meaning if it's in a natural state where it's undisturbed, how long do they spend time at those water holes? That could be a judgment of how calm your deer are, how limited pressure or issues of predation, all those type of things play into, you know, looking and observing. So a water hole could kind of be tell the tale. It can kind of give you information about your deer's psychological state. And that's another thing I think people should start paying attention to. How long are they spending at the water hole? I don't know. Right. A deer will put its head down for about 30 seconds, sometimes a minute, but very rarely is it over a minute. They're already back up. They're looking around. And so you're starting to observe each deer's own personality in that environment and starting to assess kind of, you know, how they're socializing. You know, the natural benefit of that water hole is, again, it's a location where you can take some camera data. That's really important for people trying to inventory deer and also trying to assess, you know, their deer's, you know, psychological state, because I think that's part of it. And a little tangential topic, that's a real thing.
Are minerals legal in New York where you hunt? Can you put out minerals?
No, you can't, unfortunately.
Yeah, see here in so here either. However, there's a physician and his son in Minnesota that came up with rack water. It's called, if you Google rack water mineral system, it goes into the water. It's legal here in Wisconsin. It's legal in Minnesota where you can't use other minerals because there's no attractant in it. And I really like it because you put it in the water hole, the deer are getting the minerals. This is very soluble. It's not like some of the other stuff in the past that clumped up inside of a water hole. The part I like about it is you put it in the water hole, the deer get the minerals every time they drink, whether they want them or not. It's illegal because it's not an attractant. They're going to drink the water anyhow. There just happens to be mineral in them. And the mineral you put in the beginning of the year, it's just like a cup of water that you leave out overnight. The water evaporates out, but the mineral sticks to the sides. So you don't have to keep replacing the mineral once it's in the pond. I get about a year out of it. So I would check, you know, regulations or call local warden if it would be legal in New York. But I'll tell you what, this is, it was a real game changer for me when I found this guy, and I carry his product. I'm sold out again, but, you can look him up online. It's, and he's on Instagram too, as Rack H2O, RACH2O, Rack, or just Rack, like a rack on a deer water. Real good guy and good product.
That's a good thought, because I think a lot of people, you know, in some areas where you can use mineral, you know, it's obviously, you know, beneficial to the deer. People are using it as an attractant. And we were just talking about earlier, taking camera data. In this case, if you can, well, geez, Todd, I know guys have put Kool-Aid, punch.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've
Gatorade. Ever, yeah.
Gatorade. I've seen guys do that. I mean, there's been, but I like the fact that you're adding something that has more mineral content and obviously a benefit to the deer. So, great idea. Rack.
Yeah. Vitamins. It's got vitamins and, all the minerals in it. And I really like it.
So the biggest thing for me, and I hear this, I'm going to shoot this guy down real quick, because there's a guy that I've listened to before that's talked a lot about water holes and his preferences. And I like kind of the natural pond settings. You can make them large enough. Again, I mean, those are ideal. The succulent or the type of vegetation that exists in those areas, particularly riparian zones. I mean, you're starting to look at just water in general in the landscape. How do you manage, you know, the vegetation around those? Usually those areas have the highest mineral content. And, you know, there's a major benefit to the deer that's a major attractant. I mean, people a lot of times think that the deer are naturally attracted to the water specifically, and it's actually the food, a part of the water. I mean, it can be even the algae or the plant life that's existent around those. I can think of a bunch of different plants that I've observed over the years where deer are consuming these because, particularly in drought situations in the summertime. And then we get into hunting season, and a lot of these, you know, the forbs have now senesced, and you don't have, you know, the forb availability across the landscape. And by the way, there's still food sources in and around these water sources that are highly attractive to deer. And people are always like, well, it's the water. It's water as a resource that becomes valuable to the plant life. That's usually number one. Number two is the water hole. And you've seen a lot of these videos where you've got this water hole and this deer's, you know, running around. It's been essentially rutted out, and it puts its whole body in one of these areas. Yeah. I've seen that. I've seen them dip their heads in. I mean, it's incredible because they're just, they're short that particular resource and they need to take advantage of it temporarily to continue onwards, particularly during
the fawns. Well, I do. So here in Wisconsin, you dig what are called not ponds, but they're called wildlife scrapes. They're legal. You don't go down more than 3 feet. And the whole idea is it fills up in the spring. And then towards fall, the water goes down, the duckweed hits. And then the following, it's really good for ducks the following spring again. A lot of times in a wet year, they hold water in the middle, or they'll be full, like around now they start to go down. So all of a sudden there's 1 foot on the bank, and then there's 2 foot of the bank. And generally speaking, nothing grows on that 1 or 2 feet. What I like to do is take, I have multiple properties, including my own setup this way right now, is I just take fertilizer around it, and then oats, millet, buckwheat, brassicas, and they grow that is such nutrient-rich soil that it grows really fast around those ponds. And now it does a number of things. It cools the soil because it cools the soil. It takes away that lip where the EHD, the midges live. That's where they get in the deer's nose, is in that hot soil right by the edge. But if you can keep in front of that with brassicas and oats and all those things, keep the soil cool and it keeps those bugs down. It gives cover for frogs to eat those bugs. And then the deer just go crazy for it. And I really like when the oats head out, those I'll put in. So as the pond's going down, it's 1 foot down, it's 2 foot down, it's 3 foot down. I keep adding so the plants are germinating at different times and in different states of maturity. And then you just see the wildfowl go crazy over that the following spring. The leftover bulbs that are down in there and the seeds from the oats pulling up winter wheat. It's a great tactic. It's a great strategy for any time a pond or wildlife scrape management, or even a pond that's dug normal, you know, in a dry year. It's really a fun practice to do. And it really cuts back on EHD by inhibiting those midges from being able to proliferate.
Great example and great opportunity for people, you know, if you have the ability to kind of resource and put one of those in, maybe with your loader, you know, with your tractor, you may be able to do that, you know, pretty quickly, even right now for that matter. So
yeah, and that's all handwork. I mean, that's not, you can't, I mean, as far as the planting and the fertilization, that's all.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's all just handwork, which is kind of fun, but it really, I mean, that's a huge impact, and it's a really a safety thing for your deer herd for EHD in these drought years when it rears its ugly head. It's a good way to fight back, and you'd be surprised how fast those plants germinate in that warm, moist soil right next to the water. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so this is a similar concept where I was talking about earlier with these beaver streams, or what do they typically call those? The beaver offshoots, we call them. Yep, and we were taking advantage of those across these like fingers in a land setting. And then everything adjacent to that now became more nutrient rich, more food availability for the deer. And guess what? The deer were in those areas significantly more than normal. And you know, the next thing I want to kind of just bump over to is, you know, when does a water source become most valuable? And a lot of times, like I keep hitting on this, you know, water becomes a resource that is a necessity throughout an entire, you know, life cycle of a deer, even in the winter months. Now you'll find in areas in the north where there's a high snow load, maybe there's a lot of cold temperatures, so everything's iced over. You'll find that they do resource water. What you do find is they're going to resource areas of water that are not flowing significantly. Water temperature a little bit warmer. Now, I'll just give my property a little bit of a boost here because the water is very constant in a bunch of different areas. So in the summer months, this is ground spring water. It's very, very cold. And it becomes a major resource these areas that I've kind of carved out adjacent to them, I've created little tributaries, and those become great resources for deer early season. The water temperature is very constant and the flow is very constant, but those tributaries that come off that water source are utilized just as much in the winter months. So there's just enough flow into those little, we'll say pockets, like small pools of water adjacent to those. The temperature is a little bit warmer, but it's not necessarily able to freeze because it's got a little water flow. That's a little trick for people. In addition to that, there's some naturally occurring in my area because of the specific vegetation. You know, there's some natural occurring water sources that are a little bit warmer just because of the type of soil that's there. Its thermal conductivity is a little bit different. And those are like minute differences that create kind of an attraction level for deer, because very, very cold water certain times of year may not be utilized as much as they may use resources like shrubs, which, and even in the winter months, there's a component of water in those, you know, those shrub tips, even in the stem, the twigs of that particular plant that the deer resource.
It's the evergreen, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll also notice, you know, in their urine, you'll see the dehydration levels increase over time because the amount of browse is not available at the rate that they need to survive. So deer go in that starvation mode, but they go in conservation mode as well. So there's something to consider there. And you can resource, you know, your water sources to make them more available and palatable to deer during certain times of year. So think about that as an example. That's kind of small bean stuff, but it can make the difference of attracting a deer on your property.
Well, and additionally, you know, in the drought, the water, so combating water, so to pivot for the upside of a drought, got some different properties that I manage that reed canary is always a problem. And usually what happens, you get a couple dry years, or you get a couple of wet years and canary gets in, either the farmer can't get to the area, cut the hay, the reed canary takes over, it smothers out the native vegetation, it tips over, lays down, now it can't dry out, and it becomes just a useless moonscape of tipped over reed canary that's too wet to allow anything else to grow. On years like this is a perfect opportunity to get in and cut the reed canary. You can, as it comes back, then you spray it off with Roundup, put brassicas in it, or put, sometimes I'll drill or broadcast beans before I cut soybeans so that when it comes back, I could hit it with Roundup. That following year, it'll come right back in to cattails. You can really fight it off, and it gives you an opportunity to use some other method that you use to kill the grass, the canary grass when it comes up with a pre-emergent, so that the cattails and the warm season grass would come in and you can really rebuild your wet meadow back to native vegetation. That's good for deer, fawning, pheasant, turkey. So I've got those going on quite a few different properties that I manage right now. So kind of switched from, we're not going to get our summer food plots, but I can dive down into some marshes and places that you can't get access to and rehabilitate some wet meadows.
Yeah, and eventually over time, the natural vegetation that rebounds in those areas is going to be more valuable to deer, particularly from a food source standpoint. So, you know, that's planning ahead really for you, Todd.
Oh, absolutely.
Great idea. The last thing I kind of want to talk about, I think we're kind of at the end of this, is there's a lot of things to look at here and when it comes to the benefits of water in the landscape. And that's kind of how we started this conversation. And then we kind of talked about how to preserve water, or in this case, you know, we just talked about, you know, things that you benefit from when water, you know, isn't on the landscape and improvements that you can make. So, you know, last thing is kind of like, how do deer lose water? And it's pretty basic, right? They urinate through fecal matter, and then obviously they exert it, it vaporizes out of their mouths. And you'll see this a lot during the rut period where deer's running around and you'll see, you know, vapor coming from its mouth as it starts to dissipate the heat. And that heat loss, and obviously the water related to that heat loss is critical. And then they're in they become in survival mode after they go through that major loss. I mean, part of the body weight loss is, you know, they can't retain the water that they presumably, you know, consumed or supported earlier in the season. So you'll also notice to the rot, the type of plants that they're consuming may have higher water content. That's another strategy for deer hunting. And so you'll notice deer existing kind of in these remote locations. To Todd's point earlier, just a couple minutes ago, this made me think about this, is, you know, areas of high water retention swamps, those type of areas, they're going to reside very heavily in those areas. Now, it's obviously contingent on the environment that they're living in, that the type of temperatures, et cetera, and their body's physiological state, where they locate themselves. But that kind of plays into the overall strategy of hunting, you know, a particular landscape. The type of food that deer are eating are obviously very, very important. You know, that is inversely, I guess, beneficial, because if you think about it, at the end of the day, you know, the water that the deer consume, like the surface water that we were talking about in these ponds, it's really inversely proportional to the water that's in their food content. So they'll choose one over the other, obviously, based on the circumstances. And like I said earlier, generally speaking, they're going to go to the food source before they go to the actual water in that example earlier, you know, the surface water for that matter. So I just want to play that into the equation. Again, that's why I prioritize the food sources in a plant scenario being more of a consideration for me. And again, being in the East, I don't experience the same things that Todd may necessarily experience in the Midwest or even further out West. So that perspective is going to be a little bit different just naturally because of the environments that I'm used to. I don't know if, Todd, that makes sense to you.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. I think the Midwest, Iowa, Kansas, you know, all this whole area is different than your area. And I think the water source, I mean, a good analogy that you're going to see when you, if you don't have water and you put in water, however you decide to do it, is just what you saw during your early season when you see the fawns playing in the water and deer sticking their head down in it and they're playing around. When rut comes around, deer, they also lose a lot of moisture through expiration, just breathing. So they're running hard during the rut. They lose a lot of water through breathing. They get dehydrated. Those ponds, I mean, one of the biggest bucks I ever shot was during pre-rut, and the does, you know how they're acting silly and giddy like a group of girls, and you just know there's a buck coming out. You can tell by the way they're acting, and they came right to the water hole, and then I heard the grunt behind them. And that same type of playing that you see in early season with does and fawns is you can get in a rut vortex right there. That buck's going to chase around and around that water source and keep that doe right up by it. She stays right by it, and it just becomes like, I always call it a rut vortex when you end up right in the middle of that chase. And that will happen, can happen, and will happen quite a few times when you have that little water source, however you decide to do it during the rut. It can be pretty exciting.
Now, Todd, just, I know that we're at the end of this, but it just brought up another point, because we've kind of talked a little bit about design and layout, but more so on the traction side of it. I mean, ponds a lot of times are used as a resource to eliminate movement. And you've seen that, you know, multiple times. So do you have any strategies around, you know, ponds being a source where obviously you can dump your scent into, it becomes kind of a limitation.
Funnel.
Yeah. Funnel. What do you typically try to consider in those situations? Let's say you have a pond already resourced on the landscape. Obviously it depends on its location and how you can leverage it, but let's say it's not in the ideal location. Do you kind of use it as a dead zone? Cause I've used it many times as dead zones.
Yeah, then if you can, what you want to do is enhance the vegetation around it towards with willows and cattails and wherever you can to create a bedding area. They love to bed by it, so then that's your preserve. Your no-go is your dead zone, however you want to refer to it. So then you just adapt the rest of your strategy to, you know where they're bedding. How do I get as close as I can to that or in between them and their food without spooking them? Simplifies it.
Yeah, and that's a good idea, because I think, you know, we could use it as a potential attractant, or it could be a detriment depending on, you know, other features that are set up on the landscape. So it's not always one size fits all, and you can repurpose, you know, particular areas to benefit your hunting per se. So I figured.
Yeah, and keep in mind, you know, that they're still going to drink from it. They're going to plant. They're going to do things. But if you add water out by your food source, that's going to be the focal point. When they come out to that thing, every single deer is going to come out. They're going to go check, smell who was there, smell what was there, and then go on with feeding. May drink a little bit, and then they go on with feeding. People have to separate the water demand from the social aspect. There's two completely different reasons that they come up to a water hole.
Yeah, it's good to think about that. And it could be both for that matter at that point. All right.
Right.
Let me, one other thing, Todd. So, bigger is better. How do you feel about that? Bigger the water source, the better. Now,
not necessarily. I mean, it depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to funnel deer, I want two big ponds so that I know they're going to go on either side of them or up the middle. If it's a little kill situation, 100-gallon pond is fine. 250-gallon pond, maybe on a hill. If it's an area where I don't want to fill it every month, you know, then I'm going to go a little bigger, or I might not put it there because I don't have access. So that's how I kind of look at it. Depends on what you're trying to do with it.
Would you say that there's a minimum size? I know it's obviously it's contingent on, you know, we just talked about the weather conditions or wanting to go in and fill up those areas. Would you say there's a minimum size water hole?
Depends on the use. I mean, some guys will use the 50-gallon ones, and that's fine in an area that it may be a stream trickling into it, or you'd be able to funnel into it easily. I guess, you know, by asking that question, like the 50-gallon ponds, the nice thing about the earth blind ponds is they're low profile. You don't have to bury it at all. You can just lay it down on the ground and fill it with water, and deer can come up and drink on it because it only is about 12 inches high,
yeah.
Which is another real benefit, because I don't know how many times I showed up and someone's like, yeah, I wish that pond would have been just over here because that tree's blocking it. Where I tell people, put it on the ground, fill it up, and make sure you have it in the right spot. And if you want to tweak it, move it over 20 feet or something, then you can. And then once you have it right, then you can bury it.
Yeah, that's a good.
But
yep.
Yeah, so it depends on the application of what you want that pond to do. But I mean, 50-gallon, 20-gallon, whatever you got, it's water. If you have the ability to walk out there every day and dump a 5-gallon bucket of water in it, then that's good enough. You know, if deer are going to use it.
And I would say in the East Coast, in our areas where we get a fair amount of water, you're not really filling those up a lot. You're filling up usually once a year, and you don't have to really go replenish it. At least it depends on the location and the setup and obviously drought conditions, yeah. Et cetera. But rarely am I refilling my water holes. So I just wanted to put that out there. It's just a matter, yes, of maintaining them. Like Todd said earlier, and he gave everybody a kind of a great strategy there. So appreciate that bit of information, Todd.
Yeah, a little bit of bleach, and then always have a pool skimmer net with you for leaves in the fall. One good cleaning there, and you're set.
Yeah, so Todd's running around with a skimmer and a chainsaw. That's kind of
funny. It was funny because my buddy was doing some work here. A guy used to work around the fire department, and he goes, hey, where's your pool skimmer? I got some stuff in. And I go, it's on my tractor. And then this new kid, after a while, all of a sudden he goes, can I just ask God? What are you doing with a pool skimmer on your tractor? And I just started laughing. I said, doesn't every good farmer keep a pool skimmer on his tractor?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I could think of a joke, but I think it's inappropriate for this podcast right now.
Yeah.
Okay, man, I think that's it. Anything else on your end?
No, it's good. Good luck, everybody. You probably won't hear from me again till deer are hitting the ground. So
yeah,
good luck to everybody and have a safe hunting season.
Yeah. We'll hear from you again once we get a kill. We're going to save a lot of habitat stuff till kind of the later half of hunting season. We've got a kind of plan with the podcast going forward. So I'm excited to share that. It's going to be something that Steve Shirk and I are going to do together. But, you know, we've got a couple more habitat, you know, focused podcasts. And then, you know, we'll get Todd back on just after hunting season. And then we'll start to think, you know, more about planning, implementation work, the things that we want to focus in on. So, hey, man, thanks. I look forward to talking to you during this hunting season, and we'll always stay in touch. And I hope your clients do well this year.
Sounds good. Have fun. Thanks. Thanks, John. Take care.
Right. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Bye.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.